Welcome back. My name is Mike, and this is part 2 of episode 8. If you've just finished part 1, you're in the right place. If you haven't, there's a lot of content we cover in part 1 that you're probably missing. If you want the whole story, you'll need to jump back to episode 8.1 and listen to that. But if you're all set and good to go, then I got you. So without further ado, please enjoy episode 8.2 with Hayley Worley. Welcome back to part 2, Hayley. It's again so great to have you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really loving chatting.
Yeah, I'd love to go a little bit behind the scenes and understand how you first prioritized your ideas, time and money at the start of launching the Shit Society. Can you take us back to that time and what that was like?
Yeah, that was such a struggle. I guess, you know, people talk about startup capital and, you know, what money you need to start a business, and no one kind of talks about keep going capital, and that's kind of where you need most of your cash. So, you know, being a product-based business, we invested all of our initial investment in product. And so by the time we got the product here, there wasn't really much money for anything else. So that meant we had to, you know, do our own shoots and build the website out ourselves. And we didn't have that kind of runway that a lot of brands starting out have. So for me, it was about being conscious about keeping the balance between business building and revenue generating, and trying to split my time equally. And as far as prioritizing money, everything that we spent money on in the early days needed to have a return. You know, we couldn't be launching campaigns that were just for brand awareness. They needed to be for conversion, because we needed to make sure we had a viable business and people were, you know, able to purchase that product. So yeah, it was a really fine balance to contend with, but I read a book early on called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and that really set me up for success. And yeah, just being mindful that everything I was doing had to see a result was what kept me going in the meantime. And you know, if it was my part-time gig early on, I guess I could have been a bit more relaxed and, you know, taken a bit longer with things. But because I jumped off the deep end, I needed to be really ruthless with time and energy and even headspace too, you know, to be able to, you know, look at a product and, you know, be in the facts and figures and be building a business and looking at cash flow, but then also free up your headspace to think creatively about, you know, what's coming through in design and textiles and colours and things like that. Yeah, that's something I really struggled with in the beginning, because you need to be in the right frame of mind to do each of those roles. So yeah, it's always a struggle.
And how did you find, or how do you find the context shift between creative and design and like analytics and business and growth and that mindset? Like, what do? You mentioned you kind of split your time between two different parts, like building the business and generating revenue. Do you think about it the same way when it comes to your time and where you put your attention in the business itself?
Yeah, always. And I'm much more mindful of that now. And I'm much more mindful of the power of being in the right headspace for the right thinking. And so, you know, having the flexibility to wake up and say, I'm feeling creative today, I might follow that path. Or, you know, being really deep into numbers and spreadsheets, you know, there's a time when you really enjoy that, but, you know, not when you have to or you're made to do that. So having that freedom to flip between the two and follow the way your headspace is feeling is really important to make sure you're putting out the best work in each of those areas.
Yeah. And how do you find that works with working with others? Like, you know, being able to take time, to go deep creatively might not be necessarily a linear process. Like sometimes creative work can be 2 steps forward, 20 steps back, 2 steps to the side, and you never know where you're going. I imagine that sometimes could present some challenges to your team who are probably, you know, working to schedules or trying to ship orders. Like, is there some natural conflict that maybe creativity gives you in your business?
Yeah, there definitely is. And I think we're lucky as a business. The core of what we sell is those sheets. So, you know, the coloured sheets is what makes the business great. And that's pretty much on autopilot at the moment. Like, we've created this beautiful product and it's just making sure we're in stock of that. So there's not that pressure to say, okay, what's the next big thing, you know, next month? You know, what are we bringing out for Christmas? it's not, we don't have that deadline, and that our business isn't relying on those ideas to stay afloat. So we're really lucky that having a core program enables us to be a bit more free and fluid with how we design these fashion items like the corduroy. And we spoke about boucle before. I can't predict that. Like, I can't go into trends and say, hey, this is going to be cool. We're leaning into trends like that. So, you know, we mentioned the velvet was really popular, and that was just a case of it coming through naturally, and us picking that up as a brand naturally. So although it annoys my husband sometimes, who is a very analytical person, he will say to me, okay, what's your ideas? And I'll say, well, I haven't had them yet. And he's like, well, just tell me what they are.
you don't understand. I haven't had them.
Yeah, I know. You can't just pull an idea out of nowhere. You need to have the right headspace, and it needs to be in the right context, and it needs to have that thought behind it, and for it to be a meaningful idea. So, yeah, I think having that core business that's our kind of always on, or business as usual, and that's kind of our bread and butter, has allowed us to be more fluid and easy with all the other stuff. And taking that pressure off really helps with creativity. And as a team, we're really implementing this thing. We're calling it the dwell, where we have an idea and everyone kind of, has their say on it. And then we don't talk about it for a week, and you just let it sit in the back of your head. And I think that's when best ideas come, is when, you know, you've sparked something and then you can think about it, you know, when you're in the right headspace. You know, you might be driving home and just listening to the radio, and you know, an idea might come to you. But yeah, the power of the dwell is what we're embracing at the moment.
That's actually a really interesting idea, and this concept of dwelling makes me wonder around your process, like end ideas. Is there a particular time or a place that you get your best ideas, or you start drawing these really interesting spontaneous connections? Is there a certain way it looks, or is it pretty free form and flowing?
It's definitely free form and flowing. I think if you try and put parameters over something creatively, that's when you start to create friction. I really believe that freeing up your headspace is the best way to approach that.
And with ideas as well, you mentioned like a key part of the process is dwelling. So you take that week to rest and come back. The way that you kind of described it, it sounded like it was a process that was more than just you. It was like, it sounded like a team. Is like new fabrics and like the concept of a new product something that you tackle as a team, or is it something you initially have some kind of spark of an idea and do some work on individually in isolation before coming back to the team with some further details? Like, how does your design process work at the Sheet Society?
It's a bit of everything, and I think that's what makes it so magical, is that, you know, we would have customer service say, people are asking for this, you know, can we deliver on that? And, you know, we'll have our marketing team say, hey, we want to shoot in this location and we think that it would be really beautiful. So you've got to take it from everywhere, and I think we have such a beautiful collaborative environment at the Sheet Society that, you know, even our warehouse manager can come up and say, hey, what about this, guys? I want to change this process, or I think the customers would really enjoy this, or, you know, how about we add this step into the packing process? So having that open door and creating that environment where, you know, everyone can play a big part in shaping the way that the brand is and the way that the brand can grow is really important, because, yeah, product is so important, but it's also all those other things that help sell and build the brand. Product is just one element in it, but, if the marketing team say, hey, we want to, design this ad type that's like an interactive Instagram story, but we need, we need a way to interact with the fitted sheet, and we want to do a time lapse or things like that. It kind of comes from different areas, and it's a bit of a push and pull. But yeah, it means that everyone feels involved, and then, you know, the outcome's the best. I'm not kind of locking myself in a room saying, okay, I've found these ideas and this is what we're doing. It's always a bit of a conversation.
It sounds like you leverage the mindset of your team, and everyone feels like they're part of the business, like they're a stakeholder in what they get to create with this business, which is really cool too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I eventually want to get the customers involved more in that too. Like we've mentioned, maybe doing surveys and, you know, asking people exactly what they want. And I think the brand is in a really good spot now where we can do that. You know, we've been through that stage of actually saying, okay, guys, here's the vision. Get on board with it. This is what we're trying to do. Now that that's clear, it's like, okay, help shape the future of this brand. You know, what do you want to see from us? You know, you love our stripes range. Okay, cool. Let's add some more stripes in. Let's go, you know, darker stripes, you know, things like that. So how we can build out on the product offering with the customer involved too.
That's really cool. I was hoping you might be able to like take us back to one of the first international photo shoots that you'd have ever done in Greece, and what it was actually like to carry about 120 kilos of, you know, bed sheets through customs into a foreign country. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Oh, this is a great example of sometimes things don't always go your way. So the business had probably been around a year old. We'd had our cotton program and I wanted to launch into linen. And having, you know, linen is obviously grown in Europe. So we get ours from France. Selling the idea of like a European summer, this beautiful Mediterranean vibe was, you know, right on the top of my mood board. So we booked this beautiful shoot location in Greece and we were going to go over, and it was perfect timing because we could shoot in like July, August when it was cooler over here, and we could have all the content ready to launch our summer campaign, which starts in like September for Australia. So then it was finding a supplier of linen, and that's really difficult to manage because they buy the yarns from Europe, and then the raw materials are shipped over to China, and then that's where it's woven and dyed. And so I guess in that process, China don't really have a handle on the supply chain. So they're at the mercy of how much linen is grown in France. So finding the suppliers that can access that is really difficult. So we tested a few suppliers and we gave the supplier the go-ahead. And obviously it's a really small order because it's our first range and linen's much more expensive than cotton. So we weren't able to invest quite heavily into it. But it got to the stage where the factory were dying up our bulk order, and the Chinese government had put regulations in for dye houses to cap the amount of emissions that they were bringing out into the waterways, which in theory is so fantastic and like we completely support that, but in execution the dye house decided that they would only work a half amount of time. Instead of figuring out a way to cut their emissions by 50%, they just decided to cut their orders by 50%. So that meant our order was getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back, and it was always the smallest one. And so we kind of never got forward with that, and it kind of happened that it was like 6 weeks late and then 7 weeks late, and then this photo shoot was approaching and I still hadn't seen the samples, and I was just getting nothing on the phone and nothing on communicating with them from Australia. So I jumped on the plane and I went over there. And the plan was to go to China, pick up the samples and take them to Greece. So arrived in China, still nothing, went out to the dye house, closed, nothing we could do. So in the end, I managed to take the raw linen fabric, take it to my digital printer over there, and we digitally printed the solid colours in the 5 colours in the range. So had my samples that I could shoot, and once we shot them in the background, then we would have been pushed through the dye house, and by the time we got there, shoot images, then it would have launched as a capsule. So yeah, at this stage I'm in China with 120 kilos of sheets and trying to figure out a way to get to Greece, and all the big airlines charged you for extra baggage per kilo, and it was just extortionate. And so I found an airline that went through Russia that you could buy an extra bag rather than an extra kilo, so I could fill them up to 23 kilos. And then by the time I arrived in Greece, it had just been such a nightmare to get to this point. And, you know, obviously flying through Russia, and then I came out of the airport in Greece. And if you can imagine, like, I'm like a tiny statue of a girl, and I had like 6 massive suitcases and I was just frazzled, and I was just like happy to be there but just like at my wit's end. The lady from customs wagged me over and she was like, what are you doing, what is all this? And so I was like, you are not taking these off me, I have come far too long to get here. And so I just had to kind of talk my way through, and she was like, okay, what's in this bag? And I was like, bed sheets. And she's like, okay, what about this bag? Yeah, bed sheets. She's like, and all these other bags? I was like, I really like bed sheets. Yeah. And in the end we got through and she thought I was a bit mad. But, yeah, we did the shoot and look, it was really beautiful. But when we launched the images online, the customer just didn't relate to it at all. And, you know, if anything, it was quite arrogant to see this Melbourne brand thinking that they could shoot in this beautiful setting in Greece. And, you know, our customers just didn't relate to that at all. So it was a bit of a shame, but it just goes to show, you know, hard work and dedication, you know, can only get you so far. But yeah, I mean, I don't regret it at all. It was a really great learning curve. And, you know, to this day, you know, we've got such a successful linen program, and, you know, this season we're doing another relaunch. We've got all of our solid colours in cotton coming over to our linen program, and we're launching this really killer stripes campaign. So it's just one of those things you go through to grow out the business, and you obviously make some shit calls, but at the end of the day, you get through.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a really great learning experience, because if you have to do an international shoot again, you know what to expect around supply and product and customs and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, I'm not going to say never again, but it's still quite raw.
What went through your mind when that customs agent waved you over? Was it panic? What was it?
Yeah, it was. And obviously, I don't condone lying to a customs agent, but at this stage, after everything had happened with like the fabric and the mills and then going over and then having just been in Russia to get to Greece, I was like, there's just no way you're taking this off me. I don't care if I sound like a crazy woman. So, yeah, spinning this story about needing to change my bed sheets every night, and I was on holiday for, you know, 5 days, but, you know, I couldn't possibly sleep in the same set every night.
That's an excellent story.
You've got to do what you got to do.
I'm curious about the manufacturing side of things as well, because obviously there's the manufacturer really kept pushing your order back and back and back, which puts pressure on shoot dates and delivery and things like that. I want to understand a little bit about your process to find your manufacturers and where you went in the beginning to source your first manufacturer, who would be willing to work with you. Because, you know, I've heard stories of young businesses at the start that could not get a manufacturer to even like return an email because of their size and order quantities and things like that. So how did that process look like for you?
Yeah, I think with that being my background, I kind of came into it a bit arrogant, if I'm honest. You know, I've been traveling to regions like Guangzhou and Shenzhen that are clothing manufacturing towns, and I kind of knew them like the back of my hand. So I, you know, asked people if there knew people who made bedding, and I tried to kind of figure that out. I wanted to be close to this Guangzhou fabric market because that's where all the fashion textiles were coming out. But I just was met with blank looks from everyone. And then I guess it kind of took a bit of a blow to my ego, but it just meant that I needed to do more research. And China is a really unique place. So I've been in car journeys, you know, for 4 or 5 hours before between towns. And, you know, I've gone through this big town and I've asked the person in the car, you know, what's this town? Like, what are they specialized in? And, you know, there could just be this massive town that just makes tube socks. And so it's definitely region orientated for where different product is manufactured. And so having that understanding meant that I just needed to find my town, my bedding town. And so I took on an external agent. So just via Upwork, I just found someone, you know, in Hong Kong who spoke the local language and was able to research different areas that I could buy from. And it was important for me that that agent wasn't tied to like a long-term relationship. It was more like an introduction. And it was also important that he, you know, was able to look at it quite objectively. So I said, you know, in China, I don't care where it is, find me where the best suppliers are. So, you know, a lot of agents, you know, will take you on and then you always work through them and then they manage the factory profile. But I knew that once I was introduced to the right factory, I could work with them directly and not have that middleman in there. So that was a game changer. He came back to me with, you know, 10 different factories and said, okay, these are who they are, these are who they make for, these are where they're located. I sent them my spec sheets and they said, you know, these are the approximate prices that you're looking at. And then after that, just jumped on a plane and I took him with me, and he introduced me to a few different factories. We went out there, and after that, the next step is to get them to sample for you. So I think that the best thing about that is to have just one clear spec and give that same spec, so all the exact same information, to the different factories, so that when you get your first samples back and your first costs, you can look at them and know that they were all given the same brief. So it's a good starting point.
Almost like a controlled experiment, right? Like they get the same thing. Let's see what they all produce.
Absolutely. And then, you know, you've got to sleep in them, you've got to test them, you've got to wear them, and you've got to find that good relationship as well with, you know, what you're going to work with them. And especially from my point of view, like I'm giving them all my personal money. and they're the key for me being successful in my business. So the first supplier that took us on for our cotton program, he was really fantastic, and he was willing to take on our small quantities, and I kind of sold him on the dream as much as I did on the product. And then after 6 months, he just was like, Hayley, I can't keep up with you anymore. I'm sorry, but your best option is to find someone else. So that threw a bit of a spanner in the works initially. And then we, you know, moved supplies because I had all those relationships and I'd kind of sampled with a few others. So it kind of made the move a lot easier. And then probably 6 to 9 months after that, he called me up again and said, hey, I've moved factories and I'm really ready for you. I want your business back and I want to work with you again. So, yeah, we've been working with him ever since, and having that relationship is so important. And it's honestly been really hard being a female founder and going over to China quite often on my own, and then entering into environments where it's a male-dominated industry, especially when you walk into a factory. You know, they take you upstairs and you're in this man's office, and it's quite a daunting experience. So that's been a struggle in itself. We've had a few suppliers come out to Melbourne to meet us as well. You know, I'll greet them and then take them into our meeting room. And, you know, the first point of call is for them to walk over to my husband's desk and introduce themselves to him, like he owns the company. So it takes a bit of a blow, and it's certainly a struggle, but, you know, it's just one of those things culturally that, you know, you need to deal with. And, you know, my husband's really good about it. He says, oh, don't bother talking to me. Like, I'm not the boss. She runs the whole thing. So, yeah, it's a tough one. But really, like, I've got such a great relationship with my suppliers now, and they're really, really key to us growing. And, you know, I think it's important, you know, to push them to a sense, but then to also understand that, you know, they're working for you as well. And, you know, part of our the way we work is we'll never push them to meet unrealistic deadlines. Like, we'll never penalize them for being late, any of that. And that's just, yeah, about building that relationship, which I think in the industry has just improved substantially, even over the last few years. Like, I remember working with Chinese suppliers, you know, 10 years ago, and, you know, you would just be pounding them. But now it's like a much more collaborative nature, and transparency is really key. So, yeah, I love dealing with China, and I hope I can portray that enough to our customers that, you know, it's a conscious decision to produce from there because they make the best product and they're the best to work with. And, yeah, China gets a really bad rap, and it's kind of sad.
It sounds like in that whole experience as well, like being a woman just made the experience inherently harder. Because of the history and the way that things kind of worked in a lot of ways. Like, it's a male-dominated industry. You know, there's cultural things at play. There are, you know, masculine things at play. Being a female founder, how did you work through those challenges yourself? Because it does, I imagine, take quite a lot to put that aside and think about the greater vision of the business and what you're really there for. But at the same time, it sucks that you've still got to experience that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I kind of like to say that I'm a bit of a silent feminist. I don't believe that you need to shout it out and say I've been treated unfairly, because I think sometimes you're just, you know, reiterating the problem. So for me, it's just about not even acknowledging it, just moving forward and being like, cool, I own the business, so if you want to work with me, you're going to have to chat with me and move your ego aside. So,
you need that, like, I'm CEO bitch business card.
Yes. But, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm headstrong and, yeah, arrogant enough to just kind of push through. And I just brush it off, you know. I don't let it get to me. And, yeah, I'm confident enough to keep pushing through.
And is there any like advice in that experience that you could pass on to other female founders as well that might be considering making a product overseas and, you know, the things that they might be in for to kind of expect in a lot of ways?
Yeah, I wouldn't let it hold you back at all. Like China especially is a really safe place. So I've never felt unsafe in that, in any situation, even, you know, traveling there on my own, and just owning it too. Like the only way to prove these old men wrong is to just actually prove them wrong and to be present and to push them. And yeah, I'm sure our suppliers look at me now and they're just incredibly proud of this. And, you know, I have that level of respect now that, yeah, I had to earn in the beginning, but yeah, it's definitely, made it a bit more sweet at the other side.
And when you made the transition from your first manufacturer to the second before you went back to the original manufacturer, did you notice any difference in the product? Like, what was it like? So I bet that one manufacturer, like, they would source cotton from a certain way, they would mill it in a certain way, or they would, like, they would have unique things to their manufacturing experience that they would do that would give the product characteristics that perhaps another manufacturer doesn't have. Did you notice anything, any difference, any quality improvements, like lacks, things like that, that, you know, you were like, oh, I can live with this now, but I really want something better?
Well, I think that's the really great thing about our product and the way that we've designed it is that it's exactly to our specifications. So, you know, we have a certain yarn count, we have a certain density, we have a certain weight, we have, you know, a certain cotton plant that you're able to harvest. So, like, being really clear and defined on all of those details meant that, you know, we didn't notice a difference. And I guess that's really important to us as a business because we don't sell things in sets. And for a while there, we had, you know, pillowcases from one supplier and fitted sheets from another supplier. And, you know, we couldn't show the consumer that they were ordered on different times because they've bought them as a set. So that was just having a really clear spec sheet. And of course, things are different, like the barcode stickers upside down or, you know, the cartons come in wrong. But yeah, it's just that quality control, which I think we nail because we're really clear about what we want. You know, we know that we want, you know, branded zippers from this supplier. So that's on our product, take it or leave it. So yeah, there were a few hiccups, but I don't think you would have noticed.
And in all this process, it sounds like having strong relationships formed and even to start are really important to the success of a company that's trying to produce product out of China. Like you mentioned, the almost like negotiator that you hired that could kind of go out and source things for you. You had to build a relationship with that person and they then built a relationship with the manufacturer who then you built a relationship. There seems to be a lot of rapport and relationship building in this process. How key is that for you and your business at the moment?
Yeah, so important. And I think that goes down to another issue. You know, we're hiring at the moment and that, like, people management and, you know, finding the right people for the role and, like, getting them along for the journey and, like, having good communication. And yeah, I mean, you can have a really great product, but if you don't know how to communicate that or sell them on the dream too, that can be really detrimental. And I think with that, like, honesty is just so important. I'm never claimed to be an expert at everything I do, but, like, I'll certainly give it my all and try. So, you know, if you're honest with your suppliers and you know, quite often are, hey, I know I need X, Y, and Z, but I don't know about, you know, these other things. This is what I'm trying to solve. Can you help me? That humility and, you know, that willingness to take them on board too and utilize what they know as well has been really important. And that only comes from, you know, a good place of, you know, being responsive to that and being collaborative and, yeah.
Humility sounds like it's a really important part of the process as well, because something I think about a lot is, like, I'm not the expert in a lot of ways either. Like, I'm not the best podcaster in the world, but I know that there are other people that I can learn from that can contribute value to if I can look for it myself. And it sounds like, you know, you're open to the expertise of others. You're not like shoehorning your vision as perfect. You're like, this is the vision, but help me expand it, make it bigger and better.
Yeah, and then people are more invested because they feel like they've come on that journey with you and they're a part of that as well. And that's something so special.
Now, well, you seem to be doing really well. You're set to turn over like $15 million this financial year, a figure that has, you know, grown and grown even in the last week since we've started this conversation. You've mentioned that there was a secret to your success earlier in the interview, but I'm wondering, like, are there some aspects that come together that you think make your specific secret sauce to your business? It sounds like it might be like a mix of design and product and care and attention to detail, but this dogged like resilience to just overcome obstacles as well.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I'm quite open to talk about revenue, but it's definitely not a money game for us. Like, we just love succeeding and like love growing it. And it just so happens that that number is a really good gauge of how hard you're working and how successful the business is. I don't think there's one secret behind our growth. But yeah, I think definitely the product that speaks for itself. The digital marketing piece, I think, has been a really, really interesting one for us. And you know, figuring out that cost per conversion and really factoring that into the way that we do business. You know, we call it a ROAS, return on ad spend, and we keep that under a certain percentage. And when I was learning about digital marketing at the start, there was a saying that I was told, and, you know, in the early days, you kind of use digital marketing and that as a slot machine. You know, you put some money in, not sure how much you're getting it out. And then the goal is to get that humming. So it's like a vending machine. You know, if you spend $30 on digital ads, you're going to get a conversion, and you know that that average spend from that customer is going to be X. And then, you know, in our case, they're going to come back and purchase. 30% of those people are going to come back and purchase from you. So, yeah, it's just figuring out all those metrics that's been really good to help us grow. And the great thing about digital-only businesses is that there are so many metrics, but there's also so much noise in that space too. You know, you could drown in conversion rate and impressions and all these other things that, you know, aren't that important, that as a whole make such a big difference. So for us, it was like pulling out ones that we think we can move the needle on, and then moving that needle when we can. But it all goes back to the product, right? You can sell something, but if the product's not good, they're not going to come back and they're not going to enjoy it. So, yeah, it's a big pie.
Sounds like focusing on metrics that matter is a meaningful part of your business. And maybe like the potential revenue that you stand to make is a reflection of people's response to the product and how much they're loving it. Like, if you've got a repeat rate of 30%, that's huge. Like, I don't know many brands that have that kind of level of repeat rate. So for you as the founder, the shepherd of the vision, what does it mean to you to have that overwhelming positive response and that people do really love what you make and what you do?
Yeah, that's the most encouraging thing of the whole thing. And I think sometimes I get down, but I just head to our reviews page and, you know, read what customers are saying about the brand and how they're interacting with it. And, you know, there's some really genuine comments there, like, you know, you've helped me sleep better and, you know, you've overcome all these hurdles. So, yeah, it's really beautiful. And I think if we go back to metrics and we talk about revenue, you know, the decision we made to enter into this market of everyone owning a bed and everyone being able to buy bed sheets means that, you know, we're only 1% of the market in Australia. So that potential is also huge. So, yeah, it's having an understanding of how it all works together.
I had the privilege of being able to drop off a microphone and check out your warehouse and your office at social distance, of course. And it was really exciting to see how your teams are working and packing, fulfilling orders, how your creative team's up there hustling upstairs, how you've got your showroom downstairs. I'm wondering, in this crazy, unprecedented era, have you like done anything differently outside of needing to, you know, adapt to remote work? But is the way that you're working together as a team different now than it was before March?
Oh, it's a tough one, because I would say yes, but because we're moving quicker. And I think that our employees especially are appreciating the work that's in their life at the moment. You know, we don't really have much else that's going on. So, you know, being really fulfilled in the job is really important. And, you know, we've obviously seen that huge growth since COVID. So that's helped the way that we're working together. But as far as changing ways of working, I haven't seen a huge shift. Like, we were already all like a tech business. We were already online, you know, we already used tools like Slack and Asana. So it's just been second nature. You know, we had a few staff in the office yesterday, you know, come in to pick up things or to chat, and they were like, oh, we just can't wait to come back here. So that's a really cool environment that we've created, that, you know, you actually want to be in the office. You know, we've had some interviews recently, and a few of the candidates are like, oh, can I work from home? And we're like, yeah, you can, but you're going to want to be in here. This is where the action is, like you said before, like, especially working for a startup and with it growing so much, like, you want to see the Oz Post guy try and fit 4 pallets in the back of his van every day. Like, you want to hear the phone ring with customers. Like, you want to hear the door open with customers coming in the front door. Like, you know, you want to be around it. And I think that energy that working for a business, and certainly a business that's going really well, can create, and that's a part of that traction. And I really believe that, you know, traction is everything. And I mentioned earlier, you know, how did you get started? I just did one thing after another, and that kind of starts the wheels rolling. And, you know, that feeling of having traction and you know, doing the right thing fuels doing more of the right thing, and it spirals out of control.
Speaking of the space, actually, it wasn't always a place that sold sheets, was it? I remember when we were there together, you told me about what it originally was for, and I'm hoping you might be able to share a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, so when we were looking for a new space, we were in a shared workspace out in Kensington called Click Collective. And so we were looking for a space that was big enough to have a store and a warehouse and an office. And we found this absolute dump on Johnson Street. And it was actually a testing centre for infectious diseases. So it was
ironic,
awful.
Given the era we're in.
I know. It was awful. Had these awful partitions with dodgy carpet, and then like all these petri dishes. And I remember going into the space, and I had my son with me at the time. He was like 3 or 4 months old, and there was this room at the back that was like hazmat, like, don't come in. And I was like, oh God, what is this? And to this day, we still get samples of specimens through the front door.
Wow. That's crazy. It sounds like setting up a business, you don't really know what you're going to get when it comes to the space that you operate inside of.
No, not at all. And I mean, we made the definite wrong call for coming into this space, because we've grown out of it already. So I think our warehouse is around about 120 square meters. We're looking for a new space at the moment that's over 3,000 square meters. So yeah, just the growth has been insane. And yeah, we've kind of taken a data-led approach to that decision rather than look and feel. And when we came into this space here, we were like, oh, it's huge, like, compared to what we've got. But we've had to plan out, you know, the next 3 to 5 years of a lease term and say, okay, how much are we going to grow? What volume do we need to store here? So that's so exciting. We're hoping to move in the next few months, which will be really fun.
Is the vision for the space to be the place that you fulfill out of ongoing in the future? Is that going to become like your home in Australia that you base and send product from?
Yeah, I think so. We would love to keep it all under the one roof, the warehousing and, you know, the marketing teams and the office teams. We just know that warehousing is so important to the end user. Like, we would never not do that. And, you know, that experience of packing the order correctly and making sure the handwritten note is in there and making sure the order's shipped on time too. You know, we had a sale last week, like a flash sale just before COVID hit. Before the next lockdowns hit. And, you know, because we own our warehousing, we were able to come in on a Sunday and we had a full team in and we pushed it all out and, you know, customers got their orders next day. So having that flexibility and, you know, that ability to work harder when we need to is really important to us. So, yeah, we love the warehouse, love operations. I'm not that founder that focuses on the pretty side of things, the design and the marketing and, you know, the photo shoots. Like, I'm well aware that it's the ops side of things that needs to have a really strong focus. And that's where we're focusing our growth on too. You know, if I've got growth plans in terms of growing the brand, we need to first back that up with a bigger warehouse and a warehouse management system and a really strong team there before we start turning the tap on with our digital ads. Because we never want to offer a bad experience.
Yeah, you would possibly solve a problem and create a whole lot more if you did it in the opposite.
Totally.
It sounds like in all of this, like you've definitely evolved. The business has changed over the last 3-4 years. Being the founder, how have you personally seen the business or your idea evolve to become what it is now? Because if I think about my experience with things that I've made in the past, like I've had an idea and I thought about what it looked like, but when it came into the world, it looked a little bit different, like pretty much the same, but something special was added to it when it came into existence. And I'm wondering, like, you know, getting that first version live after the Greek photo shoot that kind of, you know, was effortful and didn't really work. Like, how have you seen this kind of change and kind of the ebbs and flow of business evolve over the time?
Yeah, well, I think it's really exciting to be able to work with experts rather than the DIY approach. And there's a time and place for, you know, learning things and upskilling and really having a go. And I do believe that as a founder, you should be across everything that's in your business. But yeah, now it's like we're working with a copywriter that can help us and, like, you know, being able to hire really people that are experts at what they do to really polish it. So I feel like I kind of, you know, got the first version of the business and the brand, and then I'm having other people help iterate it to make it the best version of itself.
And what lessons do you think you've personally learned that you've got the most value out of that maybe didn't occur that great at the time, but now upon reflection seem like solid lessons?
I think the digital marketing thing was the biggest thing I learned, just because there's so much noise around that space. You know, we can go to an agency and they can say, oh, yeah, you know, we'll get this impression and this CPC and all these other things and just drown you in figures and, you know, try and make themselves look good. And I'm not saying that all agencies do that, but, you know, unless you know what you're talking about or know what to look for, there's no way you can possibly manage that side of it. And so I'm really glad that I rolled up my sleeves and really got involved in that so that I have a good understanding of that. But now I'm learning the lesson of letting go. So we say that, like, as a founder, you have to wear all the hats, and now I'm taking hats off and giving hats away. And that's a different skill altogether. You know, I started the business because I love product and that's what I want to do. But, you know, eventually we'll have a product designer and a product manager, and, you know, I won't be doing that. My day won't look like that. And I'm struggling with a whole new set of skills that I need to learn in terms of setting goals for the business and, you know, being a visionary and leading the team, which is another skill all in itself. And I'm not going to pretend I know the answers or know what to do, but I've learnt these skills through starting up the business of, you know, what to do when you don't know what to do.
What's an example of what to do when you don't know what to do? Like, what would you do?
I think just be honest about not knowing what to do. And that's why I think having a good network is really important. You know, I've got a really good friendship circle of people who have e-commerce businesses and product-based brands and, you know, saying, hey, I've got this issue. Has anyone had it before? Does anyone know what to do? Can anyone help me? And that's that humility that we touched on and the honesty. You know, even if you look like you know what you're doing, sometimes you don't know what you're doing, and that's completely fine too.
Yeah, at essence, I think everyone to some degree is just making it all up as they go along, trying to figure it out themselves.
Totally. I'm glad a lot of people are honest about that now.
Yeah. Speaking of that, actually, something I did want to cover was for all the working from home families out there and founding teams. Like, I know you and Andy, you founded this business together. You both live together. You're both partners. You both work together. You both have children. How do you manage all of that given all of that, really?
Look, in some ways it's actually great because we know how we work together, and we have that level of honesty together. You know, we could get in the car at the end of the day and be like, you really fucked that up. And I think, you know, with some founders, you know, you don't want to step on their toes. So in some sense, it's really good. In the other sense that, you know, we never stop working is also really hard. And I think that's something that we're struggling with at the moment, especially with working from home. It's, you know, you've got to just draw that line where, you know, you're not living at work and where that starts and stops. So, yeah, it's definitely a struggle. Actually, this is going to sound stupid, but I actually think having a child has really helped with that balance because it's that breaker, right? We're at the office together and our son's at daycare, but then when we pick him up, it's like, okay, cool, forget everything that happened that day. There's this little ray of sunshine in our life that just wants to see you and play with you. And so it's been really beautiful. It's helped me manage that life-work balance. And that's something I really struggled with in the early days, especially being a mum and a founder, because, you know, I've come from this hustle environment where it's like the more you work, the more you can get out of it and, you know, just work and work and work and get it done. And then having to stop and look after a little kid and start a new job that you have no idea how to do, like motherhood, no idea. There's no rule book on how to do that. You can't attend like webinars or upskill with that. You just kind of have to do it. It was really hard and I did really miss working. And so then I felt I needed to add work back into my life to keep that work-life balance. You know, people say, when they say work-life balance, it's normally you're working too hard, put some more life in. But for me, it was like, hang on, you need more work to keep it balanced. So, yeah, it's been a bit of a journey. But I think the best thing about Andy and I is we have a really good mutual respect for each other, and we're really lucky that we're similar in a lot of ways. But also our skill sets are completely opposite. You know, I'm the design and the creative side, and he's really numbers and finance and operations. So we're lucky that we have these, I guess, clear things that we look after. And it was good early on to just say, okay, if it's a decision about ABC, that's on you. And then if it's a decision about these other things, then that's on me. And just drawing that line in the sand. And it's not to say we don't have, you know, discussions or disagreements or things like that, but we know where the buck stops. And yeah, it's been really fun.
It sounds like you've got a really clear division of who has the call in what areas, and there might be challenge or discussion or debate or whatever that shows up, but you know that that other person has that final call in that domain, and that you can go back to doing your design and doing the other thousands of problems that you've got to overcome running a business and growing a business.
Yeah, and that respect that, like, okay, I don't agree with that decision, but I know that Andy strongly agrees, and I'm willing to take that on board that he knows better than I do in that space, and he's obviously making the right call for the business.
Yeah, it sounds like trust is really important to not only like the personal relationship and the family that you have, but the business that you're creating together as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you had to put in place any like different things that you do, like different ways you do downtime, or, you know, how you play with your son and then eventually will be your children? Like, have you done anything differently now that you've started this business together? Like, how do you separate that line between work and home?
Yeah, I think that's really important. You know, we set a rule a couple of months ago that was no business in the bedroom. As soon as you go into bed at night, like, doesn't matter what it is, you don't talk about it. We're here, we're going to wind down and we're going to go to sleep. And I think it's just knowing that, you know, creating space to relax and step away actually makes the time that you do step back into the business more valuable, and knowing that, you know, feeling rested and refreshed and, you know, with a clear outlook on things is more powerful than just doing more hours and yeah, working all the time.
Yeah, you don't even know at that point if what you're working on is effective and it's useful. It's just you're throwing hours at it for the sake of throwing hours at it.
Yeah, totally. And that's not great. Like we spoke about the dwell before. Like you need the time to dwell to then, you know, look at it in a different light.
And is there any like favorite way that you like to take time away from work, get space, unwind? Is due to yoga, or is there like some kind of particular Hadley method that you use that you find reliable in this crazy time?
I know. I'm a big traveler. So my husband and I, he's from England. So we spent, I think, 4 years in our 20s just traveling and living abroad. That's how we fill our cup. So it's been a bit hard at the moment not being able to travel. We had some big plans this year that obviously got cancelled. So it's just about finding other ways. You know, we've renovated our house during COVID, and that's kind of made it feel like a bit of a resort or a bit of a space that we want to be in. So yeah, it's hard. It's not one thing I do that fills my cup, but yeah, just recognizing that downtime.
That's so great. Looking to the future with where the business is going, like you mentioned, you've got the builder and you've been working on it for a few years, and you know, testing it myself, like it's coming together beautifully. It's a beautiful experience to go through. You also noted that you're doing some work with augmented reality, I believe, and a little bit of AI. Can you talk us through like just some like vision of what might be coming down the pipe for those that are following along with the journey?
Yeah, so we launched it last week, actually. So it's such an exciting tool. When we launched the Bed Builder, that was a huge part in our, like, the huge pivotal point in our business. And then we kind of threw the idea out, like, oh, what if we could do this in AR? Like, what if people can actually position their bed in their actual room? And it was kind of a bit of a pipe dream at the time, but, you know, threw it out to the network and said, hey, does anyone know anyone that can help with this? And we actually found a Melbourne-based designer who is in that space, and we caught up with them and they seemed really on board. But the issue with that was that it's an AR experience, but for a configurator. And so you jump into the configurator, and I think there's 4 trillion possible options that you can design in the bed builder. So then this AR functionality needed to be able to take the 1 in 4 trillion and project that into your space. So that was a real struggle. Like, you know, a lot of people are putting it on their website at the moment and it's like, okay, here's this chair in your space. And, you know, that technology has evolved, but the way that we had approached it is completely different. So, we've used what's called a quick look function in the AR tools that's built for Apple and Android just in your browser. So that was a really important decision to make, not to do it in an app, because we didn't want people to download an app and there'd be a huge drop-off. That's so exciting. The team we've worked with have worked really hard to, build in all of our different colours and textures. So we're able to project that out into AR. And look, it's not perfect. One of the things we struggle with is that it projects the bed on top of your bed, because it's not able to kind of like put it in your bed, because where the centre of gravity is in the AR. But I think that tech is really evolving. And the way we've built it out to work with this quick look function on Apple and Android is that we're able to adapt to whatever updates they're providing. So hopefully it will get better over time. So at the moment it's a bit of fun, and it's really cool to kind of see it. And, you know, you're actually able to like walk up to your bed and look in the bed and go around it. And if you've got like a artwork on the wall that you want to pair it with, it's a bit of fun. And I wouldn't say it's like making the cash registers ring, but it's good to position ourselves as that brand that's pushing it as much as we can. And in the tech space, I think a lot of online businesses can just, you know, build a website and it's kind of a bit set and forget. But we're really willing to invest time into building out this tech and to be the leaders in our category. And, you know, no one's doing this in the whole world. So we were the first to market with that. And I think even with this, integrating the AR with the 4 trillion options, the capability to do that within a fraction of a second. Yeah. Our AR designer doesn't think that anyone else is doing that in the world. And we built that right in Melbourne, which is so cool.
And it sounds like even if it isn't perfect now, like your iterative design culture means that just by design, it's going to eventually get better. But I think also as well, like technology is just ramping up and developments are just changing so rapidly. So it's very hard to keep pace. But your decision to keep that in browser seems to be a really smart one, given that, you know, browsers are pretty universal. Like you can download your favorite one, whatever it is, and, you know, they have set kind of settings that they operate in a certain way, but anyone with some form of device can access it. So anyone with a device could potentially be a customer for you in a lot of ways as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Given that, you know, there's a lot that you're building, there's a lot that you're trying to push forward, you're trying to push, you know, even to have an AI product or an AI tool in, you know, something as everyday as bedding, like speaks to where the company, I think, is going in the future. But I guess my real question is, how do you know when a new product is ready and ready for people to enjoy?
Yeah, I think that it's ready when you're willing to put it out there and get feedback on it. I am never one to, you know, sit on something until it's 1,000% correct, because even when you think it's correct, it could still be changed. And you don't really know that until you put it out there to the world. So I would say, you know, it's ready when it's good enough, and it gives you that, I guess it positions yourself in that way. We asked this question in an interview: would you rather be good enough and on time, or perfect and late? And it really speaks a lot to people's personality. And I'm very much a good enough and on time, especially when you've got so much on your plate. And you know, by sitting on something, it can then hold you back in all these other things. And you know, talking for traction before as well, like I'm the worst at spelling because I'm like, you know what I'm trying to say. I'm not going to try and perfect it for you. I'm moving on to the next thing.
It's good enough.
Yeah, totally.
No one's going to read this artifact in history.
I know, which is probably like, if you're a perfectionist, it's probably a shit way of looking at it. But for me, I'm on to the next thing already, and that's more important to me because I'm moving in 1,000 miles an hour, and if it means by fixing my typos, if I can't do this other thing today, then I'm sorry, I'm just going to keep churning through.
It sounds like you keep your context on the real job that you need done. Like, spelling isn't that useful when it comes to bringing a product to market. Like, it is on the website, of course, when people buy it, because they get really annoyed about that kind of stuff. But the communication between your team, like, the spelling doesn't matter that much, right? Because it doesn't get you closer to your result. So
yeah,
I very much am connected to the, like, just in time, you know, good enough, but on time. I also love, you know, just in time design as well. Like, I personally don't believe in design for the sake of design. Like, design when you have a problem and a need for it, and design when you need to, not just for the sake of doing it all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that speaks to before when you were saying, like, where do you get your inspiration from? And that comes when it's ready.
Now, beside corduroy and boucle, are there, and if I pronounce that correctly, of course.
You nailed it.
Are there any new fabrics on the way that you can share some details of?
Yeah, we're bringing out an organic cotton. So we're really excited to move towards that. When we first launched the brand, we had an organic offering in like a beautiful warm white colour. But because the premise of the brand was to mix and match, and it was this dressing yourself, you know, like putting it together an outfit, it was our brighter colours and our pop colours that really sold, and no one seemed to be really keen on the organic. So I was all for it. And I think holistically it sounds like a good product to sell, but it just wasn't really right. And I think with everything's happened this year, you know, there's a big switch to kind of living a bit more mindfully. I'm really ready to bring it back into the product offering. So I'm really excited by that. And I'm looking into more sustainable processes. I'm really inspired by a brand called Pangea from the US. So they're using like botanical dyes, and you know, each item has a story of like how it was recycled. And you know, if they've got like an avocado range where you know, they've extracted different elements. So yeah, they've done really well over in the US. They're selling tracksuits at the best time to ever sell tracksuits.
Oh, 100%.
But yeah, I'm really inspired by that. And like, of course, we use sustainable processes anyway, like our dyes are reactive dyes, which means that we can cut down on like wastewater and you know, dye at a lower temperature. And so we're always doing that anyway as part of our always on strategy. But yeah, definitely looking into that more organic side of things and seeing how we can explore that for a business.
Wow, that sounds like it's a really exciting future that you guys, or you all, are creating together.
Yeah, it's fun to be on the other side of it and have the resources and the time to really, you know, invest back into the product. And
Well, this has been so great, Hayley. Like, we've covered so much. You provided so much value to people that are launching their own business. A lot of really like uncanny stories as well, like that trip to Greece and what that looked like. That was quite hectic. And I'm just curious, like, is there any final parting advice you'd give for any emerging young person that wants to found a company that's product-based in this current era?
Yeah, I think just get out there, like just start with one thing, and then one thing leads to the next thing, which leads to the next, and then you're off and running. So, yeah, if you've got an idea, you know, start the sampling phase. If you're thinking of a business, you know, start designing a logo, like, you know, by the time, you know, 3 or 4 weeks in, you'll have a bit of a suite and it starts to build on that. And that's where I get most of my encouragement from. So just give it a go. Like, I'm a huge hater in like the what if, like, you know, I had this idea once, but I never pursued it. Like, even if it doesn't work out, like you'll learn a lot on the process anyway. So give it all a go.
And where can people learn more about you and what you're doing at the Sheet Society?
Yeah. yeah, jump onto our website. We've got some really good pages in the footer. There's like about us and there's about our fabrics and things like that. Definitely follow us on Instagram to keep up with what we're doing, all of our campaigns that we're running. But yeah, if some people want to reach out to me on LinkedIn, I'm more than happy to chat. Just drop me a message.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you, Hayley. It's been a great conversation and I've loved getting into the details and understanding like just how unique your business is and what you are all doing together and how you seem to have really, in the last few years, built a strong business that's design and product led, but also there's a real sense of community in your space with your team. So I think it's a real testament to your vision that you've been able to pull all this together. So you should be really super proud of, you know, what you ongoingly are producing.
Oh, thank you, Mike. I really love chatting to you. Yeah, I love your podcast and yeah, you've got some killer questions and yeah, I'll always be a fan.
Well, this has been huge, but everything good must come to an end. If you liked this episode and want to hear more, you can get the goods on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast network or listening app. Thank you for listening. Until next time, this is Mike signing off.